it was a dramatic decrease, and we're trying to do everything we can to get some momentum going again.
New enrollment figures for healthcare.gov. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 13th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a new study bolsters hopes for geothermal energy in Akutan.
I think there's a customer base here. We just have to make the numbers work to see if it'll make financial sense.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an Individual Artist Award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
In Congress tonight, a massive spending package has emerged after weeks of intense negotiations among lawmakers, and it contains good news for Alaskans. Senator Lisa Murkowski, top Republican on the Subcommittee for Interior Department Spending, has announced that she's secured $66 million to staff the state's six new tribally operated health care facilities. Lloyd Miller, an Anchorage attorney who represents Alaska Native Hospital and Clinical Operator, says it will help the tribal groups who borrowed money to build the facilities and boost the economy as a whole.
Just to give you an example, full staffing for the facility in the Mat-Su Valley will produce 225 positions. That's an enormous impact in the Mat-Su Valley.
The other facilities to get funding to hire medical staff are in Fairbanks, Nome, Barrow, Copper Center, and Kenai. Murkowski says she also secured money in the spending bill to fully fund Native health care contract support costs for this fiscal year. The federal government has been underpaying these administrative costs for years, which the U.S. Supreme Court has twice ruled is illegal. The federal government released numbers today that give an idea of who is signing up for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. In Alaska, about 3,000 people selected Marketplace plans before December 28th, and 83% of them qualify for a subsidy to help pay for premiums. But Enroll Alaska has seen a steep drop off in the number of people signing up for insurance in the new year, APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Only three other states have lower enrollment figures than Alaska. Eric Erling is spokesperson for Primera Alaska, one of two insurers offering health plans on the federal marketplace in the state. He says the figure for total enrollment is low, but not surprising.
Unfortunately, given the reality of the technical challenges that healthcare.gov had after October 1st, enrollment is going to be lower than everybody expected, and those numbers reflect that.
Erling says Primera isn't ready to release its own enrollment figures. He says overall, the low numbers can be partly attributed to the fact that thousands of Alaskans are able to keep health plans that were supposed to be canceled in 2014. That's a change President Obama announced in the fall. The benefits group Enroll Alaska has signed up more than 900 people in Marketplace plans, but the pace of enrollment has slowed considerably. COO Tyanne Bowling says in the last few weeks of 2013, the company was signing up as many as 70 Alaskans a day for health insurance. As soon as January 1st hit, that figure plunged by more than half.
It was a dramatic decrease, and we're trying to do everything we can to get some momentum going again.
Bowling thinks there's a lot of consumer confusion over enrollment deadlines. Enroll Alaska is renewing their advertising effort to get the word out that people have until March 31st to sign up for insurance to avoid paying a tax penalty. Bowling says the healthcare.gov website has only been working well for about 6 weeks, and she thinks the months when it failed had a big negative impact.
I think the momentum was crushed because of the functionality of healthcare.gov. I think that we are the people that are enrolling have always intended to enroll, and so really our goal and objective is to get out to the people that aren't aware of this law and that truly can benefit from this. I just don't think people understand that there is a great benefit there for them.
As Eric Erling with Primera puts it, the disastrous healthcare.gov launch significantly altered the equation of what was possible. But he says there's still time to boost enrollment numbers, and it's too early to draw many conclusions from the federal data. The company expected the first year of the Affordable Care Act would be a roller coaster ride, and Erling says Primera was ready.
There were going to be, you know, some twists and turns that were unexpected. There were going to be events that happened in the implementation of the Affordable Care Act that couldn't be predicted or couldn't be predicted in the sequence they might happen. And so everything that the entire system has experienced the last few months is certainly systemic of that.
Across the country, 1.2 million people have selected marketplace plans on healthcare.gov. The number of enrollments began to spike the last week of November. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The operator of the North Pole refinery wants the state to set a lower standard for cleaning up the sulfalane groundwater contamination problem in the North Pole area. Flint Hills Resources Alaska has asked the head of the State Department of Environmental Conservation to set a less stringent cleanup level for the industrial solvent that leaked into the groundwater for more than a decade before Flint Hills bought the refinery in 2004. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the requests could delay cleanup for several months.
The DEC team that's been working on the sulfalane contamination case had hoped by now to be studying final reports on the problem and preparing to review Flint Hills' plans to clean it up starting about a year from now. But Tamara Cardona, who heads up the DEC's team, says that schedule is up in the air now.
There's been a little bit of a hiccup now that Flint Hills is formally challenging the cleanup level established back in 2012.
Cardona can't say how much the schedule will be pushed back by that hiccup. She says that'll depend on whether DEC Commissioner Larry Hartig grants Flint Hills request to put the process on hold while he reconsiders the cleanup level that Flint Hills must attain to declare the area's groundwater safe to drink.
As of any other work, it's pending on this decision.
Flint Hills spokesman Jeff Cook declined to comment on tape Friday, but in a written response sent Saturday, he states that Flint Hills believes the DEC's proposed 14 parts per billion cleanup level is unnecessarily stringent and that a higher level could be set that would protect human health. A Flint Hills document filed with DEC on December 20th suggests the cleanup level could be safely set at about 25 times the level set by DEC at 362 parts per billion. The response also reiterates Flint Hills' request that DEC require the refinery's previous owners, Williams Alaska Petroleum, to participate in the cleanup process. The two companies are now entangled in a years-long lawsuit over who's liable and for how much. Cardona says she can't say much about Flint Hills' requests while they're before the commissioner.
Now it's a matter of waiting what the commissioner is going to respond.
The DEC commissioner's spokesman declined to comment on the issue Friday. A spokesman for the attorney general's office says Hartig must rule by the end of February on whether he'll agree to reconsider the cleanup level. And if he does, the spokesman says that process could take several more months. Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins has for more than a year now been urging state and federal environmental agencies to get the cleanup process moving along more quickly. Hopkins says while the bureaucracies plod along and weigh Flint Hills' requests, nothing is being done to stop the sulfalane from spreading through the groundwater underneath North Pole and toward Fairbanks.
The aquifer is, you know, at approximately the same levels that it had before in terms of sulfalane, and so we just keep seeing the date move on. And I don't see a lot of action happening. I don't see a plan yet.
North Pole Mayor Bryce Ward says he's glad that residents of the area affected by the sulfalane are still getting drinking water from Flint Hills while the debate over the appropriate cleanup level plays out.
You know, are they putting a very conservative number out there? I think that that's probably a safe assumption. But the trick is, and the true question is, what is safe for consumption?
Not much is known about the health effects of consuming sulfalane, but tests are about to get underway to answer that question. Cardona says the National Toxicology Program will begin testing this month with laboratory animals. She says results of those tests should be available in 3 to 5 years. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alan Moore wins his fifth Copper Basin 300.
It was a race this year. I mean, it was close. We were nip and tuck there right at there at the end.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A new study shows Akatown volcano could be even more promising source of geothermal energy than previously thought. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has more.
It's been 3 decades since the U.S. Geological Survey last studied Akutan's volcano-powered hot springs. Since then, head researcher Deborah Bergfeld says the springs have gotten stronger, and there's more material from Akutan volcano dissolved in the spring water.
These are all good indicators that there might be a reservoir of hot water big enough to supply geothermal power.
Bergfeld says a volcanic eruption and seismic activity in the 1990s could account for the increase in power potential. The springs are now producing 29 megawatts of heat. That number would shrink when converted into electricity, but Bergfeld says it would still be substantial.
We don't have enough data to say how many megawatts of electricity you could get out of it. We just said that there would be a potential for several. So each megawatt could power about 750 homes.
It sounds like a good deal for the city's small residential population and its large Trident Seafoods processing plant. Right now, that all runs on fuel oil barged in from Onalaska. But Bergfeld says a strong volcanic resource alone isn't enough to tell whether geothermal is worth the cost of installation.
You also have to have, you know, a need for the power, so it has to be people living there. So there's a lot of economy, you know, the balance has to work out.
That's a balance Akutan is hoping to strike. They've been working on a plan to tap into their geothermal resource for years with the help of several grants. Akutan Mayor Joe Boreskin says the new USGS data will help their cause as they work on a business plan.
I think there's a customer base here. We just have to make the numbers work, and that's what our next goal is, to see if it'll make financial sense.
They hope to have that business plan done in the next month. In Onalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
While sea ice in the Arctic has been undergoing a 7-year decline, sea ice in the Bering Sea has been experiencing a 7-year expansion. Anna Rose MacArthur reports from KNOM in Nome.
Last month, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association reported the Arctic's 7 lowest ice minimums occurred over the last 7 years. The single exception to this pattern is the Bering Sea, where ice has been undergoing a 7-year expansion southward. Dr. James Overland is a research oceanographer with NOAA. He says while the Arctic is warming 3 times faster than the rest of the globe, since 2007, the Bering Sea has experienced a 7-year cooling, a trend he calls unprecedented in the last century.
In terms of Nome and southward, this persistence of cold, very icy years, 7 years in a row, when we look at the St. Paul records back for 95 years, we've never seen a run of 7 cold years in a row.
Overland says this cooling has resulted in ice extents that haven't been recorded in the Bering Sea since the early 1970s. Over the last 5 years alone, ice has stretched about 100 miles further south than it did in the early 2000s, even reaching past the Pribilof Islands.
You have to go back to some of the extreme southern extents of sea ice in the early 70s to find any comparable extreme conditions like we're seeing now.
Causing the cooling, Overland says, is a shift in air pressure. The lower air pressure system that normally hangs over the central Aleutian Islands has moved east into the Gulf of Alaska. This shift causes cold northeasterly winds from the continent to sweep over the Bering Sea, which replaces the usual pattern of warm southerly winds from the Pacific blowing over the water. Whether or not this cooling trend will continue into 2014 or beyond is unknown, primarily because scientists don't know why the air system shifted in the first place, making its persistence
all the more perplexing.
Right now, we would think it's almost impossible that you would have had a seven-year cold period. So it's really a mystery. Every year we're saying, well, we should expect more normal conditions rather than continuing cold conditions, but that hasn't happened. It's been the continuing of the cold conditions.
Overland says forces like Arctic ice, warmer sea temperatures, and El Nino, the usual suspects, don't seem to be the cause behind the change. Meanwhile, a warming Arctic and a cooling North Pacific place the Bering Strait region and the Norton Sound in the crosshairs of these competing systems.
The Northern Bering Sea and the Chukchi Sea are tied in with the Arctic, and the Southeast Bering Sea is tied in to the Pacific, and Norton Sound in your region is right on the battle line between those two differences.
Overland predicts long-term the warming Arctic will overrun the North Pacific influence in the Bering Sea. However, the North Pacific systems will continue to dominate the southeastern Bering Sea over the next 20 years. This projection derives from computer models of the global climate under rising carbon dioxide levels. Reporting from KNOM in Nome, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
And there's less than normal ice buildup on many interior waters. The National Weather Service drills into ice on rivers and lakes at the start of each month, and agency hydrologist Ed Plum says January's measurements show generally thinner ice.
Birch Lake, Harding Lake, Chena Lake, Quartz Lake, they were all about 65% to 75% of their normal thickness for this time of the year. So normally the ice on these lakes, these larger lakes, is between 20 and 25 inches thick. But this year, we're only seeing thicknesses between about 15 and 20 inches.
Plum says ice measurements on some rivers are also down, but are typically more variable due to overflow and river dynamics. He says the Tanana and Salcha rivers had ice that was 80% and 75% of normal, respectively, at the start of January. Plum attributes the overall trend of thinner ice to the unusually warm fall.
Very warm temperatures back in October, actually some record warm temperatures. And what that did was delay the freeze-up. Then in November, above normal temperatures continued as well. So we didn't get as thick of ice as we normally develop.
Plum says the ice was further hampered from growing by snow accumulation beginning in November.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by the 2014 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Alan Moore has successfully defended his Copper Basin 300 title. The Two Rivers musher held off Nicholas Petit on the final leg for his fifth victory, the most in race history. KCHU's Joni Gorman has more on Moore's historic win.
When it comes to the Copper Basin 300, Alan Moore continues to rewrite the history books. The historic win didn't come easy for the veteran. Moore knew he would have to fight Nicholas Petit on the final stretch of the trail at Lake Louise Checkpoint early this morning.
I was only 1 minute ahead of him, and he didn't even know I was in the picture before because I was taking all my rest early, and he took all of his late.
Petit left Lake Louise first and beat Moore to the first Tulsana checkpoint. Moore was able to gain the lead by leaving first out of that checkpoint. He maintained a lead throughout the rest of the race. The Two Rivers musher crossed the finish line at Old Pass Church in Glen Allen at 2:05 p.m., with Petit coming in 7 minutes later. After the race, Moore thought it was very competitive.
It was a race this year. I mean, it was close. We were nip and tuck there right at the end.
Moore's historic fifth win further cemented his views about the CB 300 being the best qualifier for the Yukon Quest and Iditarod. He believes it should be a prerequisite for any 1,000-mile race.
Some of the other races that you don't see that where if you have a race just on a river, you know, that's all you see. But here you get to see river, you get to see mountains, you get to see cold weather most of the time. You just get to see everything.
Moore's fifth CB300 victory is more than any musher in history. Three others only have two wins. This is the second separate time he has won consecutive titles. Moore accomplished defeat in 2007 and 2008. Two others won back-to-back titles, Susan Butcher in 1992 and 1993, and Mitch Seavey in 1997 and 1998. With another win in the books, Moore now shifts his focus on defending another title in 2 weeks, the Yukon Quest. He's confident that his dogs are ready for any 1,000-mile race.
Hopefully the dogs all come out fine. They'll be mentally and physically tough. They'll be ready to go into Iditarod or Yukon Quest, tomorrow. So that's one of the main reasons. That's why we put three teams in this race. We put every dog, almost every dog we have at our kennel that's of racing age, into the race.
Moore also plans to compete in the Iditarod this season. Last season, his wife, Allie Zirkle, finished runner-up in that race. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
Trailbreakers are busy packing and clearing the Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race Trail. There are no major changes planned for the route this year. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, this will be one of the busier years on the Alaska side of the trail, where dog teams are likely to encounter open water.
It's one of the better years for snowpack in interior Alaska, and many people have reveled in a recent stretch of temperatures at or above 0 degrees. But race manager Alex Olison says the combination of warm weather and thick snow means dog teams competing in this year's Yukon Quest are likely to encounter open water on the Yukon River.
Lots of snow and mild temperatures have just insulated the ground and the ice that is there. It seems like they'll have to do a lot of cutting back and forth to avoid leads. So where you would think going down a river you would just take a straight line from corner to corner, it's just not possible.
Olison says there are a number of open leads on other water bodies along the trail as well.
And we've heard it from pilots, too, that apparently these leads are in a lot of different places that they don't usually see open water.
On the upside, Olison says there are no reports of jumble ice on the Yukon, which means despite the switchbacks, it could be a smooth run as dog teams head toward Eagle and the Canadian border. He also says thick snow means notoriously rough sections of trail may not be as technical this year.
Places where there's lots of stumps and rocks will be covered up, which is nice.
A fierce November storm posed a challenge for trailbreakers earlier in the season because they had to clear downed trees and brush from the trail. Overall, Olison says with less than a month before the race start, logistics are coming together.
You pretty much assume at this point in January that the weather will get bizarre and it'll be 50 below and that everything will be miserable for everybody. You also assume that somebody will rabbit out in front at record pace. You just have to guess that that will happen. And if it doesn't, then great. And if it does, then we were right.
This could prove to be one of the busiest years for the Alaska Side Trail, with 20 teams signed up to run all 1,000 miles to Whitehorse in the Yukon, and another 25 planning to run the Yukon Quest 300, which follows an out-and-back route between Fairbanks and Circle. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
If you are lucky enough to get a permit, the McNeil River Sanctuary in southwest Alaska offers an opportunity to safely get up close and personal with the largest congregation of brown bears in the world. Since only 185 permits are drawn each year, a UAA professor decided to team up with an Alaska filmmaker to create an immersive experience for those who can't make the trip. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
When you go to a planetarium, you expect to learn about the night sky. But as I sit down in UAA's planetarium, the lights are dimmed and the ceiling lights up with a view of the McNeil River in southwest Alaska. Travis Rector is a professor of physics and astronomy at UAA, as well as the producer of River of Bears. He says the purpose of the planetarium is much broader than just studying stars.
One of the
things that we can do in our planetarium is we can give people the experience of being anywhere, whether it be on orbit around the Earth or the far side of the galaxy, underneath the ocean, or even at a bear sanctuary.
River of Bears is the first wildlife documentary ever produced specifically for a planetarium. Rector and filmmaker Jonathan Van Ballenberg used a special video setup mixed with photographs to take advantage of the planetarium's dome ceiling and 360-degree view. Rector says that technology allows viewers to immerse themselves in the full McNeil River experience, from the flight in, to time sitting in camp, to the bear viewing areas.
One of the special experiences about McNeil River is that it teaches you how to watch. It teaches you how to be perceptive about what's going on around you. And we tried to convey that feeling in the movie, where as you're watching the show, there's all these things happening. And if you take the time to look around, you'll see lots of neat little things.
Rector says because the McNeil River changes as the season progresses, it took the crew two trips to get the material they needed to put the documentary together.
In the early season, when the bears are at McFit Creek, the focus is on grazing and mating. And then as the season progresses, as you start to get into July, the salmon start to run into McNeil River, and that's when the bear viewing switches out to the pads at McNeil Falls.
Even though bears will sometimes come to within feet of the viewing areas, they mostly ignore people. This is largely because of the way the Department of Fish and Game manages the human activity in the area. In the nearly 50-year history of the sanctuary, no one has been injured by a bear at McNeil River. Despite the refuge's safety record, Rector says the thought of being surrounded by bears for 4 days is off-putting for some.
When you describe the experience that you fly out to this remote location, Alaska, and then you sleep in a tent in bear country, that alone makes many people say, there's no way I would ever consider doing that. And so there's a lot of people, whether it be the lottery system or expense or fear or physical ability, will never get the chance to experience what there is to experience at McNeil.
Rector says the goal of River of Bears is to bring the experience to that audience. The show opens Friday at the UAA Planetarium and Visualization Theater. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
For a link to the schedule for River of Bears, go to alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Delta, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Anna Rose MacArthur in Nome, Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Tony Gorman in Valdez. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C., and Josh Edge from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. A message to parents from the Alaska Department of Education. Learning to read is the basis for all future learning. Parents can help their children get off to a good start as readers. Read with your young children every day. Do lots of talking with your kids. Make up stories together. Play games with words like rhyming games. Encourage your kids to write and draw stories and ask your school how you can help your children become good readers. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.